Hello, and welcome to New Books in Environmental Studies, a podcast on behalf of the New Books Network. I'm your host, Ben Goldfarb. Today, we'll be speaking with Douglas M. Thompson, author of The Quest for the Golden Trout. In The Quest for the Golden Trout, Thompson turns a critical eye to America's rivers and examines how fishermen, like me admittedly, have transformed our waterways by introducing millions of non-native, hatchery-raised trout and physically altering the structure of rivers to make them more conducive to the fish we like to catch. As Thompson reveals, these actions, though often well-intentioned, have had some profoundly negative ecological consequences. Like any great work of environmental history, The Quest for the Golden Trout forces us to examine our own culpability in historical changes to land, or in this case, water. So without further ado, Douglas M. Thompson, welcome to the New Books Network.
Well, thank you very much. It's a joy to be on here.
Great. And Doug, perhaps you can begin by briefly telling the audience a bit about yourself and explaining what led you to write this book.
Sure. I am what's called a fluvial geomorphologist, which is a scientist that most people haven't heard of before. It's actually someone who specializes in river systems, and in particular, the physical nature of rivers, how they evolve through time, how they change their physical habitat. And I've been doing work on river restoration and working on habitat issues for a while. And as I did more and more research, I was very interested in the role that the trout hatcheries and trout management was having on the way the rivers in general were being approached, and became a little bit concerned about what I consider to be kind of an overemphasis on fishing issues relative to general kind of river health and ecosystem health. So that was one of the things that started to really pique my interest. The more I looked into it, the more I became aware of certain things I hadn't realized, even though I was, you know, studying rivers for more than 2 decades now. So figured if I was being surprised by some of these pieces of information, then I should probably write a book and let people know what's going on in some of these rivers.
Great. So let's talk about hatcheries. During the course of your book, you actually visit a number of fish hatcheries. So let me start by asking, what exactly is a fish hatchery, and what do these facilities look like?
Sure. So fish hatcheries essentially a place, you know, in the case of the trout, which is what the book is about, is a place where trout are raised from egg all the way to the point where they are ready for release into the river. And the point at which they're ready for release varies a little bit. So if we're talking about something like salmon restoration, that's usually pretty young. But in the case of trout for use for trout fishing, they're actually usually raised in, for 18 to 26 months. So they're raised really to full size, and then they're stocked in the river at that point. The hatcheries have slightly different looks to them depending on which site you visit, but for the most part, they have these concrete tanks that are either elongated, kind of concrete channels where water is flowing in one direction through these tanks, or they might have round tanks where water kind of swirls around. In both cases, the water is going at a pretty slow speed. The fish are in pretty crowded conditions in these hatcheries. They're being fed pellets that are put in the tanks in a number of different ways, mostly kind of automated systems. And there's oftentimes some oxygen to augment the water in the hatcheries.
Okay, and how widespread is the use of hatcheries in the United States?
It's very widespread. There are literally thousands of hatcheries in the United States. We're stocking approximately 150 million trout every year in the United States. So obviously, there are a lot of hatcheries to supply that that demand. And pretty much most states have a state hatchery. There are federal hatcheries run by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service as well. So there are lots of hatcheries out there.
Yeah, if you went out on any river in Connecticut and dropped in a line, I mean, how likely is it that you'd be fishing for a hatchery raised fish? You know,
On the bigger systems, if you catch a fish, it's almost definitely a hatchery raised fish. Fortunately, some of the smaller streams do have some wild brook trout, which is the only native trout to New England. In the streams, that there is also a lake trout that's native. But Again, you're not that likely to find those on the bigger bigger brooks and bigger rivers. Those would be almost exclusively stocked fish.
So why does the prevalence of hatcheries matter? Why does it matter that we're supplementing rivers with all of these captive raised fish?
Well, there's a few different concerns. One is that a lot of the fish that are being released are actually not native to the waters where they're released. And so they cause some competition with the native species. For instance, in New England, we have native Atlantic salmon, and in a lot of systems, we've been trying to restore those Atlantic salmon runs, for instance, the Connecticut River watershed and some of the local watersheds in Massachusetts and so forth. Unfortunately, the stocked fish actually compete directly with these anadromous fish. And so there's, you know, that concern. There's other species of concern that are being competed with. In other parts of the country, we have native species of cutthroat trout that interbreed with the stocked trout. And so we start to lose the kind of purebred genetics of these cutthroat trout. And there have actually been some subspecies of cutthroat trout that have been interbred into extinction. So that's certainly one concern. And then as well, the hatchery raising of the fish does actually create some pollution issues. The hatcheries themselves do have pollutants, both nutrient pollutants and also medicines, disinfectants and fungicides, antibiotics that are going into watersheds. And the fish themselves, because they are bioaccumulating certain toxins like dioxin and PCBs, when they're stocked into the rivers, they actually are a source of contamination, the actual stocked trout.
Wow, how contaminated are these trout? How much of a biohazard are these PCB-filled
sure. so
fish? Yeah.
There are health concerns, and so there are advisories on how many fish people should eat in a year, and it varies, but it's somewhere between 6 and 12. So there are actually catch limits that the anglers have, so they can easily in a couple days catch enough fish that they basically shouldn't consume any more trout over the course of a year. So again, these health warnings warn between about 6 to 12 fish a year should be consumed. So that probably gives you an idea what we're, you know, when we're stocking 150 million of these into rivers every year, what we're introducing to the river systems.
Right. I know there have been some concerns as well about the genetics of hatchery raised fish. Can you characterize yes. those worries?
Sure. So, you know, a hatchery is not exactly much like a river. So the hatchery fish basically are raised in fairly slow moving water. They're completely featureless, as I kind of mentioned before. They're just these concrete channels that really have no features in them at all. So the fish basically, as they're living in these hatchery runs, basically generation after generation of fish are raised, and they essentially start to become a little bit more genetically programmed to be successful in a hatchery. So that's not necessarily what's going to make a fish successful in a river environment. There's a number of specific issues that happen. There was actually a recent study done that the hatchery fish have slower burst speed, so they don't have that kind of quick swimming speed to elude predators. Hatchery-raised fish are more likely to feed at the surface and feed aggressively. That's probably because of the way they're fed in the hatcheries, which makes them, again, more prone to be caught by native predators. They are also have abrasion of their fins from kind of sweeping their tails against the concrete and also being kind of bitten at from other trout. There are some other concerns as well, including some specific breeds that are kind of raised for kind of an interest sake. So there are these strange coloration versions that are raised. There's a golden version, which is what the title of the book gets its name from. It's a golden version of a rainbow trout. So it's not a true golden trout. It's a golden rainbow trout, and it's this orange-colored fish. And we even raise albino fish, again, just for fishing interests, not for any sort of ecological reason.
So the golden trout was a natural mutation that was subsequently bred by hatcheries?
That is correct. It was, slightly orange colored fish initially noticed in a hatchery in West Virginia. And instead of just kind of noticing it as an interesting anomaly, the hatchery essentially then worked very hard to selectively breed that fish. And now there are a number of states, including West Virginia, Maryland, and Pennsylvania, that are specifically breeding this golden trout, sometimes also called the Palomino trout, although that's a slightly different version. I've also heard of these fish being raised in California, but they're basically a bright orange, kind of goldish colored fish that are, again, raised exclusively for the idea of kind of generating interest in fishing with these somewhat odd-looking fish.
Yeah. And why did you choose that particular odd-looking fish to represent your book, to be the title?
Right. Well, in some ways, it's the book is a fairly heavy topic, and so there's certainly some topics that are kind of hard to digest. And so I tried to have some humor in there as much as possible just to make the book more interesting to read. And so the golden trout was actually a kind of reference to Monty Python. I certainly enjoyed many Monty Python movies, including Monty Python's The Holy Grail. So the golden trout was really meant as a metaphor for the Holy Grail, this idea that there's this kind of magical fish out there that we're somehow trying to find, and in some ways it's kind of this quest that is probably not going to be very successful, and in many ways maybe kind of a waste of time.
Are there hatchery management practices that you consider more appropriate, more in ecological balance? I guess thinking about how we can reform the management of these fisheries and rivers. Is there any role for hatcheries to play?
I think there probably has to be a role for hatcheries. I think the book, I'm not saying that we shouldn't fish. I'm not saying we shouldn't have hatcheries. But what I'm asking for is a little bit more effort placed on focus on native species and some more preservation of some more pristine watersheds. But I think there's going to have to be some sort of balance between rivers. It might be more of a working type river where because there's a lot of heavy fishing practice, there might be need to be some hatcheries. But certainly I think there needs to be also equal emphasis placed on rivers where we're not stocking these fish, where we're looking more natural processes. And in terms of the hatcheries, basically there are studies done, more scientific kind of smaller scale studies, showing that we can do things to help the trout being raised be a little bit more predator wary and so forth. The problem is it's expensive to scale those practices up, and a lot of the hatcheries are really looking for just mass production. And visiting some of these and talking to some of the hatchery staff, I mean, they really are talking about meeting quotas and so forth. So it's very much about producing the maximum number of fish for the least amount of cost. So that's certainly not very conducive to quality, as you can imagine. So I think there needs to be a call for better quality fish and not just quantity.
Are there any particular states or hatcheries or entities that you think are doing a better job of having their priorities in the right place?
I think a place like Montana is really been at the forefront. Montana has been working very hard to not stock in rivers and try to have wild fish as much as possible. Now, not all those wild fish are necessarily native, so there are some issues with that. But they are focusing most of their stocking efforts in reservoirs and areas that are already probably artificial in many ways. I think probably Montana is probably leading the way at this point.
Okay. So how did we get to where we are? You know, what are in your book, you trace the historical trends and factors that led us to this place where we're pumping in all of these hatchery raised fish into our rivers. What maybe you can explain it to us now.
Right. So I think back 100 plus years ago, the idea was that if we could spread new species to new rivers, that this was going to improve on nature. There was a general feeling of scientific management that nature was inefficient and that humans could help to design better ecosystems. So there was a lot of work done to bring species like brown trout from Europe over and stock them throughout the United States. Rainbow trout were brought from the West Coast and stocked in other areas, including all over the East Coast. There were species of East Coast fish brought to the West Coast. So there was a lot of this effort, including food sources. So there were different food fish and some non-native mollusks and snails, which we now have great concern about, which were stocked widely in the 1880s and so forth. Again, with this kind of idea, this kind of somewhat false sense that we could somehow improve on nature. And it really was at a time when we didn't fully understand the issue of genetics. We didn't really understand what DNA was and so forth. We didn't understand how interdependent a lot of species were in ecosystems. So we now realize that there are a lot of problems when we start to play around with exotic invasive species and so forth. So that's kind of how it all started. There was a lot of interest in fishing that started to generate around that time and moving forward. And as things like automobiles and trains took more and more people out to rivers, there was a greater fishing pressure. Some wealthy individuals started to privatized many river systems as a result of that. And fewer and fewer places were open for public fishing. Pretty soon the fishing wasn't very good. And so hatcheries started to become the solution to small numbers of fish being caught. And so the hatcheries are dumping in many, many of these exotic invasive species, trying to supplement what was in the river systems. Unfortunately, the results weren't that promising. After several decades of doing this, people realized that really we weren't kind of solving the problem. They started going into a little bit more heavy-handed management of the rivers themselves by trying to actually physically modify the rivers, what was called habitat improvement. They tried to put in these different kinds of structures, which are really a very engineered, again, solution with this whole idea that humans could do a better job than nature. And it kind of just kept spiraling in that way, that rivers became less and less a natural wild area and more a human construct. And again, that's really one of the themes of the book, is that a lot of people like to visit rivers, myself included. A lot of anglers like to visit rivers with this sense of connecting to nature, but as humans became more and more interested in improving fishing, many rivers are less wild and less like they really were when the time when trout were swimming and healthy populations throughout the regions.
Right. You just referenced the rise of private wealthy fishing clubs, which is a theme that runs throughout your book. Maybe you can talk a little bit about those clubs. Who was in them? Where they existed? What they did?
Right. So there's been a long history of wealthy fishing clubs in Europe. And when some of the nouveau rich in the United States wanted to try to help establish their credentials, they began to form up as fishing clubs. So there were some very famous fishing clubs on Long Island, for instance, that had some of the wealthiest individuals you can imagine, Carnegie, Vanderbilts, some big, big names, Kennedys, and so forth. So and one big family name as well that was very important was Roosevelt's, and including fathers and uncles of the two presidents. So that ended up being important, I think, in the way the federal government eventually got involved. These fishing clubs spread to other parts of the Northeast, including Pennsylvania, up into the Catskills. A number of big, important clubs formed up in the Adirondacks and throughout New England as well. So these fishing clubs became areas mostly for wealthy individuals, some of them were very, very exclusive, people basically used it as a kind of status symbol, as used it as a way to kind of meet up in social settings with some of the wealthiest individuals. One of the things I raised, which is kind of interesting, there's been a lot of kind of praise for these fishing clubs for preserving land. And yes, in many ways, they did preserve land, which is wonderful. But a lot of the people actually involved in the fishing clubs were involved in some of the problems that really resulted in the loss of a lot of the river environments that naturally would have been supportive of trout. So people involved in the railroad industry, people involved in major manufacturing, building dams and polluting waters in a lot of ways. And so there's kind of this strange situation where people were getting very rich off of kind of stripping the land of its resources and causing a lot of problems to river systems. But then they used that wealth to buy some private estates and private fishing club lands that now are some of the few places left that are in better situations, although there are certainly some problems in those lands as well.
Right. One of the really remarkable episodes that you detail in your book that I'd never heard of that was fascinating was how one club in particular modified their stretch of river in such a way that they produced a catastrophic flood that killed many people. What happened there?
Yeah, so that many people have probably heard of the Johnstown flood. This was essentially the part of the story that's not that well known is that the flood itself was caused by a dam that ruptured, and the dam was essentially owned by a private fishing club at the time. Again, some very famous steel magnates like Andrew Carnegie and Frick were involved, and essentially they were. Part of this group that bought this dam, there was a nice reservoir upstream that they used for fishing and for sailing purposes. It wasn't really a high priority to them, so they didn't put a lot of effort into the maintenance of the dam. There were warnings about the dam basically being poorly maintained. There were problems with erosion. There was an outlet which would have been an important safety feature on the dam that was not properly maintained. And then during a heavy rainstorm, which was probably exacerbated by the fact that the local watershed had been mostly logged, and so there was a lot more runoff. The dam was overtopped by flow that eroded away the dam, and we had this massive flood that headed down and resulted in one of the biggest loss of life ever in the United States for a natural disaster. And The sad thing is that there was a trial and this was brought to court, but the courts decided that this was an act of God, even though there was clearly some negligence in the maintenance of the dam.
So not only were these private fishing clubs really influential, I mean, certain individuals were hugely important in shaping the way rivers and fisheries are managed. And there's some really vivid and memorable characters in your book. None more so than Edward Hewitt. And maybe you could talk about Hewitt for a minute. Who was he exactly? And how did he affect river management?
Right. So Edward Hewitt was kind of one of the group of New York industrialites who was using kind of fishing as a way to kind of promote their own social status. His father had started kind of a rags to riches story, married into the Cooper family, who was the grandfather was, again, a rags to riches story, but by that point was very, very wealthy. So Edward Hewitt ended up growing up in a fairly sheltered, very wealthy environment. They had a large mansion out in New Jersey at Ringwood. It's a place that you can go visit now. It's an enormous property, big house, and so forth. His father and uncle were both mayors of New York City and were very important in iron development for the Civil War. So Edward kind of grew up with this wealth and so forth, and in many ways a kind of a spoiled upbringing, as you read his autobiographies. He did go to school and went to graduate school as well, but really didn't make much of a name for himself in industry, but became very well known as an angler and used his wealth to start to modify major areas of the Neversink River, wrote some books about this that became pretty well read. And that those books ended up being kind of the first kind of documented cases of using these structures, these habitat structures I mentioned before, to start to physically change the way rivers look and the way they operate. This was picked up by another very important individual, Carl Hubbs, who was a scientist at the University of Michigan at the time. He ended up becoming one of the most famous fisheries biologists in the U.S. He read some of Hewitt's early work and became acquainted with some of the fisheries people who were in New York working for the state government at the time. This started to blossom into this research program at University of Michigan that was quickly picked up by the Civilian Conservation Corps by the Roosevelts, by FDR in particular. And this ended up really changing from just a small private undertaking to a federal investment with Civilian Conservation Corps dollars in a fairly short period of time. And that's where this modification of rivers suddenly became a nationwide massive undertaking.
So when you talk about the modification of rivers and the introduction of structures, what sorts of structures and what are how do fishermen attempt to modify a river to make it more conducive to fish?
So the initial concern was probably well-founded. There were problems with logging and so forth that had caused some concerns to that rivers were being kind of inundated with sediment and didn't have the habitat they used to. And so the solution people came up with was this kind of fixed in place type of designs. And there's a lot of different designs, but there's a few groups that you can kind of lump things into. One is referred to as a deflector structure. And as the name kind of implies, the idea is to deflect the current. So it's something that sits on the side of the channel typically and kind of forces the water to flow around it. And in doing so, that helps to scour out a deeper area of the channel, a deep pool area. Another type of structure is actually a small dam. So although large dams, it causes all kinds of problems to rivers. The hope was that these smaller dams would actually create, again, kind of some scour and some deeper water. And then the last kind of big group of structures are called cover structures. And the idea is that fish also need places to hide underneath. So these structures were built out of wood and rock. And initially they were built, somewhat in a flimsy sort of design. And so quickly, instead of becoming about habitat and ecosystem, it quickly became about engineering. So they started building bigger and stronger structures that would withstand the currents and so forth. The problem is that when you really look at the history of how a river generates good aquatic habitat, it's really a dynamic process. So rivers like to move side to side. Rivers like to create scour in some areas and deposit sediment in other areas. Trees and so forth falling into the river are actually very important for creating cover habitat, creating scour. And so what you actually would like to see is a river that has some kind of motion side to side, some vertical motion as well, and that these things kind of have this long-term kind of regenerative sort of habitat. So when you start to instead replace this with a fixed-in-place type of structures, you're really actually working against nature. You're working against the natural processes that should generate some very good habitat. So that's really the concern. And it's unfortunately something that's continued into the current day in many cases. One of the most common approaches to restore rivers nowadays is called natural channel design. And again, it is a very heavily reliant on these fixed-in-place structures, which in some cases might be warranted if you're talking about in a city environment where you don't want the river to move and undermine a road or a building. That's one thing, but they're still used in places which are more natural and really probably should allow the river to behave in a more natural sort of way.
So I guess given what we know about the natural behavior of rivers, why is natural channel design so popular today?
It's popular partly because it's a fairly easy kind of cookbook type approach. And so the idea is that people go to these short courses and get training for a few weeks, and then they're kind of certified to go out and do these projects. So it doesn't require really the full background in how rivers behave and evolve over time. And one of the most interesting things I found out, I certainly was aware of natural channel design and the way that those practices were being conducted today. But when I went back and did the research, it was very fascinating to learn that Carl Hubbs, working with the U.S. Forest Service back in the 1930s, had also basically had these short courses where scientists, Forest Service rangers and so forth were being trained for short periods of time, two-week long sessions, and then being kind of certified to go out nationwide to do these projects. So it's kind of that legacy of short-term training and being able to follow a very simple formula so that, it's easy to follow and so forth. And so it's unfortunately not really what's in the best interest of the river systems.
Has there been a lot of pushback from fluvial geomorphologists like yourself against natural channel design?
There definitely has. There's actually was a position statement, a group of fluvial geomorphologists like myself with the Geological Society of America actually had a position statement come out a little over 10 years ago with the concerns about the fact that we weren't really considering the history of a river. If you think about the rivers and throughout the country there, we have, unfortunately, a long legacy of humans impacting the rivers. And so certainly I think the first step we'd like to think about understanding how to fix these problems is to figure out what are the problems in the river themselves. So how has the river changed over time? What are the specific causes of the problems in the river? So that's what geomorphologists would like to see happen, is to this an initial study to figure out what really is it wrong with the river and kind of go with a systematic historical approach to understand how the river's changed. That's not something that is done with the natural channel design to any degree at all. Typically, they just pick a river they think looks pretty good, and they essentially try to make a copy of that river when restoring a different river. So it's trying to kind of do a cheap Xerox kind of copy of a river, as opposed to really understanding why there are problems in that river in the first place.
Right, but I mean, a lot of these problems and the history of alteration goes back so long that I'd imagine it's very difficult to understand, exactly what's happening in the river. It's been happening for so long now, right?
It's very difficult to figure that out. But certainly I think there's some hope. There are certainly a lot of geomorphologists working on that. It's something that I'm working on right now with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and some other groups up in Maine to try to get a sense of what did the habitat used to look like for the Atlantic salmon and other anadromous fish in that ecosystem. I think the first question is, what did the rivers look like before humans came along, and then we can understand what they look like now, and then we can start to understand basically what kind of changes have taken place. And so there are people who are doing that, but it's a little bit more involved process, and it's not something you're going to learn in a week or two of courses doing natural channel design. You need someone who's has the background to really do that sort of investigation.
Right. So your book is in many ways a I don't want to use the word takedown exactly, but certainly has some harsh words both for the natural channel design apostles and also trout fishermen and their inflated regard for their own sport and their influence on rivers. Have you gotten any feedback from any of these people, any fishermen or natural channel design proponents?
I haven't heard much from the natural channel design folks yet. I certainly have heard from folks who are have concerns with natural channel design. They're very happy with the book. I think the angler group is a kind of a group that I was hoping really to reach, and I was kind of waiting with bated breath to see what kind of reaction I've had. And so far, it's been pretty positive, actually. So I think that trout anglers, again, the rivers are going to be in a big trouble if trout anglers don't care about this issue and these issues I've raised. And so the folks who have read it have understood that I'm not trying to say we shouldn't fish, that we're not, that's not the problem. The problem is the way we're approaching this. And so there was actually an article that came out in the Hartford Current several months ago that kind of painted me in a little bit more antagonistic sort of fashion than I think the book really comes off. And there were some anglers that kind of were kind of displeased with what was said in the article and what they thought I was trying to say. I gave a talk actually at a library in Newport, Rhode Island, and a few folks showed up. They initially started off kind of very skeptical. By the end of the talk, they were a little bit more open-minded. A few of the individuals bought the book. And including a president of one of the local chapters of Trout Unlimited. He read the book and it actually invited me to Trout Unlimited chapter so I could talk. He said it was a very important book. He thought that all the members of his chapter should read it.
Wow.
That's what I'm hoping for. I'm hoping that there are folks who understand that I'm not saying that trout fishing is the problem. What I'm saying is that there are concerns with the way that we're doing this, and that if we really care about rivers, which I think most trout anglers do, then we need to make some calls for some changes. Because right now the state and federal governments are under a lot of pressure. They're not necessarily hearing the other side of the coin in terms of, preserve the rivers themselves and, concern about the rivers themselves. They're mostly hearing about, what the fishing's like and so forth. So they're pretty focused right now on the fishing in many cases.
Right. You yourself are a lapsed fisherman, right? Or a former fisherman. When was the last time you fished?
I last fished in the mid 1990s. And that was, partly because I started growing concerned again in the way that the trout fishing was kind of driving decision making, and unfortunately I realized that if I'm buying a fishing license, then I'm buying into the system, because the money for the fishing license is being funneled back to the state agencies and so forth, and being funneled back into things like the stocking practices. So, you know, personally for me, the decision was I was a little less, I was a little more concerned about those issues. And so I decided that, you know, I still love to see trout. I still, you know, I try to bring an underwater camera, take pictures of them. I still enjoy them in a lot of ways, but for me, I didn't want to purchase the fishing license and continue to support the practices that I consider to be a little problematic. So that was a personal decision I made back in the 90s.
Okay, and there are a couple. Is at least one scene involving your daughter fishing, right? Does she fish at all herself now?
No, she did. She was very interested in learning to fish, and her grandfather, who has since passed away, took her out fishing for 2 days in a row, and she did enjoy that very, very much. She's now, you know, she knows about the book. She's read the book, and at this point, her decision is not to fish. But I certainly would not stand in the way if she decides that she wants to do that. You know, I fully understand that. I don't fault anyone for wanting to fish. I fully understand it. I fished since I was a kid, and I still love fishing. I hope I can fish someday in the future. But I just don't feel at this point that I'm very comfortable with what that entails in terms of the, again, investment in the state and federal agencies.
Fair enough. What's your personal favorite body of water? If you could spend the rest of your life exploring and studying a single stream, where would it be?
It would probably be the place I did my research as a graduate student in Colorado. I really like North St. Vrain Creek. It's a beautiful river that basically is pretty far from houses and roads in most places. It begins in Wild Basin in Rocky Mountain National Park, so you can imagine that's a pretty beautiful location, and then extends through this fabulous canyon for miles and miles before finally, unfortunately, popping out into a reservoir down near the foothills, down near Lyons, Colorado. It's a fairly well-known creek, I think, for many anglers, but there's a lot of places along there that anglers probably have not visited before because they're remote areas.
How about closer to home? What are some of your favorite rivers in Connecticut?
Sure. I do a lot of work on the Salmon River and some of the watersheds in the Salmon River in Connecticut. And again, it's a river with a lot of potential. Right now, the potential is not entirely reached. We're unfortunately losing the salmon. So it's going to be a very sad day when the Salmon River no longer has salmon in it. But it is a beautiful watershed in many other ways. And so I've done a lot of work there over the years. It's also a place that has, again, a long history of humans kind of modifying the river. And so you can actually still walk along parts of it upstream in an area called Blackledge River area of the Veterans Fishing Area. So that's part of the Salmon River watershed. And you can still walk along there and find structures that were put in place in the 1930s by the Civilian Conservation Corps. And it kind of shows that these structures that were put in place are there for a long, long time. And unfortunately, one of the problems is that they've basically limited the river's ability to modify itself. And they've actually impacted tree growth along the sides of the rivers. So that's actually resulted in a long-term negative impact. So, but it's, again, it is a beautiful watershed. I have hopes for it in the future to become even more beautiful.
Doug, what's the current state of salmon restoration in the Connecticut River? Didn't the federal government just remove its funding?
Yeah, so the federal funding, the federal government has kind of pulled the plug. When we had Hurricane Irene come along, one of the major hatcheries up in Vermont that fed a lot of the salmon for the Connecticut River watershed as a whole was damaged by that flood in the White River area of Vermont. So the federal government has decided to kind of pull its funding there. It's the future doesn't look very good for the Merrimack River up in Massachusetts, and it's decided to focus most of its interest instead on anadromous other anadromous fish in the Connecticut watershed, but also the salmon. It's going to focus more on Maine. States are still trying to keep the salmon restoration program moving ahead, but the fact is the numbers are very, very low. You know, right now, 100 returns in the entire Connecticut River watershed would be considered, you know, a pretty normal or good year. So it's wow. It's state of the salmon are pretty dismal right now in the Connecticut River watershed.
Well, Doug, I hate to end on such a somber note, but it's a sobering book. I consider myself both a conservationist and an angler, and The Quest for the Golden Trout certainly made me think long and hard about how to reconcile those two pursuits. Doug, I want to thank you so much for coming on the New Books Network today and for writing such a compelling and hugely important piece of work.
Well, thank you very much. It was a joy to write it, and I hope people do enjoy it. And again, I just trying to open people's eyes. I'm certainly not trying to tell anyone how to live their life, but certainly I hope it raises some awareness.
I think it certainly achieves that. Well, thank you again for coming on the show, Doug, and that's today's program. Tune in next month for New Books in Environmental Studies. Till next time, I'm your host, Ben Goldfarb, on behalf of the New Books Network.